todolisthome.com. Welcome. I'm your humble host, Tony Teolis, and I'm keeping track of things to do around the home. This is episode 6 of the To-Do List Home podcast. What's going on in Japan? Coming to you from Northern Virginia in the USA. More information on this podcast and others can be found at todolisthome.com. The song of the day is You Really Wake Up the Love in Me by the Duke Spirit, recorded on Neptune from 2008. Have a listen at amazon.com, and the link can be found in the show notes. What drives this? This is my way of paying back years of using the internet for research, learning and improving permaculture techniques to help build community, sufficiency, and reliance. Retiring at age 55 or younger. And thesurvivalpodcast.com. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com today and learn how to live the good life if times get bad or even if they don't. Today's gardening chore, starting basil and pea seeds. Now actually, here in Virginia, it is April 8th, 2011, and just about everything I'm going to put in the yards so far has already been started as seeds, and I actually started the basil and pea seeds several weeks ago, but I thought it important to focus on these two plants and explain what I did. As mentioned before, I have the basil and pea seeds that I've ordered from Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, located in Mineral, Virginia. And with the basil seeds, as I did the last couple of years, I get a small container with a little bit of vermiculite. The container has some holes in the bottom of it. I put some seeds on top of the vermiculite, then cover with a little bit of extra vermiculite, place it in a container that's got water in the bottom, and let the vermiculite wick up or soak up the water. And soon as the seeds start to sprout and a couple of the first two true set of leaves appear, I will go ahead and transplant those or pot them up into a special potting mixture of Mel's Mix. Please refer to episodes 1, 2, or 3 for a little more information about how I start seeds and Mel's Mix and square foot gardening. For the peas, though, this year, I've realized since last year that when I plant peas, sometimes it's hit or miss whether or not they sprout and how well they sprout. I've also been finding information that when you plant pea seeds, you should first inoculate them, place them in some sort of legume inoculant and let them soak that, and then you put them in the soil. However, this year, something that I got from the Survival Podcast was I just treated my pea seeds like I do all of my regular annual seeds. I placed them in vermiculite, covered them with more vermiculite, and let that soak up water. And I end up with a very strong sprout. Sprout in total length is sometimes 2 to 3 inches long. That includes the bottom white root coming from the seed and a nice top shoot, a nice green shoot coming from the top of the seed. I've already got, this year we're going to have a good crop, at least 24 of those shoots in 3 separate plots out in my yard. And I probably got about 30 overall that I've spread around in the yard, and it's going to be quite a pea season, I have a feeling. They're very strong. They've already been in the ground for a few, it's been about a week now. Put them in the ground last week, and they're really coming up. They're about 4 inches off the ground already and developing their third set of true leaves, and those leaves are approximately 1 to 1.5 inches wide already. So a very fast-growing plant, and I know I have to get out there tomorrow and plant some sort of trellis system for them, and what I'll do with that is pretty simple, and I'll explain the simple trellis that I use is very easy to set up, and that'll be in an upcoming episode. The other thing on my gardening chore I wanted to get into, because although this again has been in full use since basically the middle of February, I wanted to explain how I put my grow light system together. In the show notes, I've included a PowerPoint presentation that is just a simple picture of what I have set up in my green room, as I call it. And on the second slide is just a little crude diagram of what you'll need if you want to set up this simple grow light system. It is basically employing the use of two cement blocks with a 1-inch by 5-inch by 6-foot board across the top. Underneath the board, I screw in two eye holes set about 44 inches apart or so. And from there, I hang a regular old shop light that I picked up from Home Depot for, I think it might have been about $5 at the time when I picked these up a couple years ago. In one of the light spots, I put a 48-inch kitchen and bath fluorescent light. And in the other slot, I put a 48-inch residential fluorescent light. The reason for the two different types of light is to allow for a full spectrum of light. It's not by any means a substitute for the sun, but it certainly does help your plants start out well and help them to grow true and strong. In the diagram that I have, I set up the system that I actually have in my house. And I actually have two of these. So you'll see four cement blocks supporting two boards each and two lighting systems underneath. And underneath each lighting system, I have enough room for, I would guess, between 50 and, if you really wanted to be adventurous, probably up to at least 80 or 90 plants that you could probably put. But your plants, if everything goes well, will grow and grow, and you'll need to pot them up into larger containers over time. So eventually, I may have under a lighting system at any one time maybe 50 small individual plants, but as they get larger, I have to reduce that to about maybe 15 once they really start to take off. And again, if you refer to episodes 1, 2, or 3, and the planting times link will take you to a spreadsheet that shows what I'm planting, when I'm planting it, when I'm moving it, when I'm transplanting outside. So it gives you an idea. It's a pretty constant rotation, and having help from the kids to do this is a real, real blessing. As you can see from the diagram and what I've written there, there are also two eye screws I use to hang each shop light. So very inexpensive project, very easy to put together, doesn't take up much space, and makes a world of difference between having plants that are ready to go out in the yard that you can start from an individual seed to having to go to Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart or somewhere else and buy your plants that you don't know where they came from and put those into your gardens. Also, in this episode, I'm adding some home chores because, as I stated in episode 1, I do a lot in addition to what I have to do regularly with work and family. And some of my chores are actually quite interesting, at least enough to me, that I want to share them, and this website helps to keep track of them. So, my first edition of some home chores. 1, helping my daughter build a beehive for her school insect project. Now, this was due on, I believe it was April 1st was when she gave her presentation. So it was due at her school on March 28th, actually. And I had known about this for a couple of weeks, and if you've been listening, I'm preparing to put bees in my backyard, and I know a lot about bees now. We had discussed what kind of insects she wanted to do for her school project, what we would do, how would we do it, and then we blew it off for about a week and lost track and had to revisit the subject again. She wanted to do something that you would actually find in nature. I did make a very honest attempt to try to find how to explain a beehive that goes on in nature, which is not quite contradictory to what I've been learning of what I'll be doing in my backyard. But I started to get an idea in my head that if we built a miniature backyard beehive, similar to what I have in my backyard, included what the beehive will actually look like in the honey and the queen bee and worker bees, if we included pollen and brood. Brood is the larvae and the pupa of the honeybee, and was able to explain it and all the components that go together and bee facts, that we could possibly end up with something pretty interesting. So 2 weeks ago, we put our heads together on a Friday evening, and really hammered out a real nice project that folds up into a box that she was able to carry to school. And as you can see by the pictures, it's pretty self-explanatory. I'm not going to go into details, but it was one of those chores that I had to do. And this one, I didn't want to forget this one. The other one, a little closer to my heart and soul here, is preparing packages to send to Japan. In episode 1, I explained a little bit that I would be talking about Japan over future episodes. If it wasn't for Japan, I wouldn't be here. I had to have a to-do list in order to get to Japan. I had to have a to-do list ready in order to get out of Japan. And I've got family in Japan. We really didn't quite understand what was going on in Japan until last week when I spoke with my sister-in-law over there. And I'll be explaining very shortly a little bit about her situation. But we've got three sets of good people over there, and we went shopping last week to Costco to pick up our regular food, but we really wanted to put some nice packages together and send them to the people that we knew could use them and bring a little bit of comfort to people far away. So putting these packages together, as you can see from the pictures again, they're pretty self-explanatory. You may be wondering why we're sending the seaweed there. Well, there's a lot of concern about food that's made in Japan, and we know people near the affected areas that we wanted to send some comfort food that they're regularly used to, but also some great things like garlic toast snacks, chili, Vienna sausages. We've got granola bars and some really nice cookie sets. We've got some curry that's already prepared in some packages. It's a nice thing to do. It makes us feel a little more useful rather than just making a donation to a place where we don't know where money would end up in the first place. So, I'll get into that. If you know somebody in Japan, just for the hell of it, send them a card, send them a package, even though they'll tell you they don't need anything, they're doing fine. Chances are they could use a little bit of cheering up these days. On my to-do list today, what is going on in Japan? As you can see from the show notes, there's a map of Japan, and I wanted to point out where it is exactly that we lived in Japan. And if you can see Tokyo, no, pretty much, that's where I spent most of my time. My Japanese family, my sister-in-law, husband, and her three children are just about 20 miles, 30 kilometers due east around Tokyo Bay in Japan. And more or less, they live on what looks like reclaimed land. It's more or less where I spent most of my time, the different jobs and different living situations I had there. As you know, there was one of the world's largest earthquakes in over 100 years, magnitude 8.9, 9.0. Jury's still out on that one a little bit. An earthquake large enough to move the seabed of Japan 28 meters, or about 70 feet, shook the country on March 11th. What followed was a tsunami of untold proportions, something never like it in the history of the world. Smashed into, if you look on the map again, an area directly north of Sendai. So you'll see Sendai, which is on the main island of Honshu, right above the little airplane symbol. And it wiped out more or less about 400 miles of coastline, and most of that coastline was inhabited. Following that tsunami, within that area, just a little bit south of Sendai, was a Fukushima nuclear reactor plant that everybody's been hearing about so much. The earthquake was one part of damage to the nuclear reactor. The tsunami was something completely different. Japan got a double whammy within about 20 minutes on March 11th. Great loss of life. I'm not even going to speculate on the count, because that probably deserves a little bit of further patience before you'll actually put a number. But it's huge. Huge. Whole town's completely wiped out. As I mentioned, my sister-in-law lives a little bit south of that, about 200 kilometers south of where the nuclear reactor is, about 250 miles south from the epicenter of the earthquake. And in this area, what they had incurred was a huge earthquake that just shook the hell out of everybody throughout pretty much the whole country. But a lot of it, you know, a lot of the people in Tokyo really were scared out of their wits. My niece and my nephew, my niece is about, I think she's 18 right now. I went roller coaster riding with her, spent the day riding roller coasters last year when they visited here. She's not afraid of anything. and this earthquake made her cry. So I know it must have been a scary as hell earthquake. My nephew was home with her, so that was good. My younger niece happened to be in school that day, and just like a regular earthquake drill, she was under her desk and said she wasn't bothered by it too much at all. I don't know. 90 seconds under a desk with everything shaking around you, that girl's pretty unshakable then, if she wasn't scared. The damage that had incurred and what I'd found out from my sister-in-law after the first few weeks of her telling us everything is okay, everything's fine, nobody got hurt, was, and we found this out last week, which prompted us to go and put some packages together for them, the sewage treatment plant in their neighborhood hadn't been working since the quake struck. For almost 4 weeks, she was without running water, no ability to take a bath, no ability to use the toilets, no ability to do any cooking. Draining water in general was just not going to happen throughout their neighborhood. As a result, they had to ship in porta-johns and place them in different places around the neighborhood. I also learned from my sister-in-law that the carport in the front of their house was actually raised up and part of the ground was lowered as a result of the earthquake. A bit disconcerting hearing all this. In order to maintain their hygiene, they've had to go to the local bathhouse, not that frequently either, every other day from what I understand. They've had to go out and buy food outside of the house pretty much every day for almost 4 weeks. So there was no real storage of food going on in their house, no storage of water, no storage of extra clothes, no preparations for anything that you would think typical that people would prepare for in an earthquake-prone country such as Japan. However, much like here, the official guidance from the government, which should always be taken as a first step, not the only step, was to have more or less a 72-hour emergency bag. And when you have a long-term emergency, an aftermath like this, unforeseen circumstances, 72 hours can go pretty quickly. My sister-in-law's in-laws live approximately 100 miles due north of her in Gumaken, or Guma Prefecture. They have had no gasoline, so no car transportation, shipments of food and vegetables and fruits have been stalled, rice shipments have been stalled to their stores, and severe power outages have been a regular occurrence for them. They're in their 70s, they're really great people, they've always been really great to me as a foreigner, always accepted me, and one of the packages that's in the pictures is for them. And now my sister-in-law's mother-in-law also has parents that live not too far from her that are in their 90s. And so we have people in their 90s and 70s, more or less living like they're under siege and without resource. How have I been finding out what is going on in Japan? It took me almost 3 weeks to find out what my sister-in-law was really experiencing, although we had been in contact with her more or less every other day during that period. I lived in Japan for more than 8 years. I developed some great friendships, and I still keep in touch with some of the people living there, whether they be Japanese or foreigners. I have 3 very close friends that whenever I am in Japan, I always do my best to make contact with and meet up, because that makes the travel of 14 hours on an airplane so worthwhile. First, there's my friend Dermot. Dermot has been in Japan since 1983. He arrived as the head of the Bank of Ireland in Japan. I knew Dermot because he hired me back in 1999 to be a salesperson for the company that he owned. Next, there's my friend Henry. Henry's been in Japan since 1992, and I met him through Dermot's company. It was a small company, and Henry and I worked together on several projects related to Y2K at the time. Henry's background is in disaster recovery. My other friend, Neil, is from New Zealand, and I know he's been in Japan at least since 1995, but probably longer. Neil, I like to call the Prince of Roppongi, and I'm only going to share that. If he's listening, he'll get a kick out of that. Neil and I met when I worked for Kawamura International Communications in 1996, and we worked together providing military English services to Japanese air bases throughout the country. very unique work opportunity, and we got to work together and get to know each other and actually become pretty good friends. So from them, I wanted to discuss what was going on in Japan. On March 14th, I wrote to these three friends of mine. By the way, these guys will probably never leave Japan, no matter what happens. So I wrote to them, "Hi, I wanted to check in with you and see how you and your friends and family have held up. That must have been one hell of a bad earthquake jolt. I know you're far from most of the damage, and my sister-in-law is too, but just wanted to hear back from you. If I don't hear from you, I'm calling next." So very shortly, I received my first message, and that was from Dermot. And here's Dermot's message. "Hi, Tony. Great to get your email. Good news. All here are accounted for and well. I was in the house with one of my boys at the time. The rest of the family were out and about. Yumiko was attending Collins High School graduation ceremony. We had some anxious hours as the mobile phone system went off after being overloaded. Also, all rail and subway transport was stopped. Eventually, everyone got home late in the evening after long walks across the city. Here in Tokyo, it was shocking, but people reacted remarkably calm. But going through it at the time was a totally frightening experience, and we were 230 miles away from the epicenter. A lot of tidying up was needed as everything flew off shelves. The biggest hit for us was the breakage of some wedding present, some Waterford crystal glasses. A small price to pay compared to those who unfortunately lost their lives or were injured. We still have a big worry about problems in a few of the nuclear power plants. That will play out over the next few days, so we're all quite anxious. Please keep well, and again, thanks for checking in. Best wishes to you and your family." My report from Henry goes as, "Tony, thanks for checking in. We and our extended family are doing fine. As you said, we're far from the area of serious damage, so far. Our only big problems are the rotating blackouts, greatly reduced train schedules in Tokyo, and some supermarket shortages. Monday was chaos, but we'll get used to doing the laundry at 4 a.m. Take care." And my response from Neil, "Hey Tony, it's okay here, but everyone's gone a bit crazy, panic buying. All the supermarkets around here are empty, as are the gas stations. CNN coverage of Tokyo doesn't cover the suburbs out here, and it's different folks are worried about the next one within the next 3 days. Maybe the predicted big Tokai quake, which hasn't hit Tokyo since 1923. Plenty of places I can go to, but you know what it's like here when a government doesn't say shit. Getting better information from CNN. The New Zealand government has advised to evacuate Tokyo, so I might leave tomorrow. Just really because getting food or anything around here is getting pretty hard. And the Japanese are starting to panic buy and hoarding, worsening the whole situation. Friends and I have motorbikes, gas, food, and cash, so if we need to, we might just start heading south." What I needed to do after those three messages and communicating with my sister-in-law, reading the news myself, trying to get everything else done in the meantime, I checked back in with my friends on March 19th, and they replied back to me, and these replies are a little more in detail and give a better understanding of what people have actually been going through in Japan. From Dermot, on Saturday, March 19th, "It's a beautiful, sunny spring day in Tokyo. It's hard to believe that the images we see on TV are happening in this same country. Life is somewhat normal in Tokyo, but still, transport and working hours are not yet back to the way they were before the earthquake. By the way, we still get frequent aftershock earthquakes every day. My worry is that we have not yet got the big one that is predicted for Tokyo based on the 60 to 80 year historical cycle of big Kanto region earthquakes. The last one came in 1923 and killed between 100,000 and 140,000 people. The March 11th one gave us a taste of what a real earthquake feels like, and it was bloody frightening. The recent quake had a magnitude of 9, but the epicenter was under the sea and located 230 miles northeast of Tokyo. When the big one hits Tokyo, it doesn't need to be as strong as magnitude 9. Anything above a 6 will do enormous damage and result in great loss of life in Tokyo. So that's a real worry going forward. The memory is now current instead of something remote in a history book, so So on a beautiful day like today in Tokyo, I put these thoughts into the back of my mind and try to enjoy the moment and forget the risk and watch the events on TV as if it's happening in some far-off place. Tokyo is now home for me, and I no longer say I have kids. Yes, there are 4 boys in the house, but the youngest are nearly 19 and the eldest is 23. So they now make up their own minds about where they go, but they do appreciate the offer of a safe bed in Virginia. Some things are in short supply in the shops. Cup noodle, bottled water, milk, and toilet paper. It seems that people are hoarding the stuff. I don't know what it is about Japan, but I guess nobody wants to die with a dirty ass. Maybe it comes from some ancient Confucius or Buddhist wisdom passed down through the generations. So for now, I plan to stay here in my adopted home, and I don't care if I shit in my pants with fright in the moments just before I expire in the big one. It's shogunai for me, mate. Hope you're all well. Looking forward to your next return trip to Tokyo. Just a little interruption here. As a result of people asking Dermot what's going on in Japan, he started his own blog, and I have the privilege of reading a little bit from his first post, posted on March 19th. Tokyo is home to 1/4 of Japan's population, but there is an overhanging problem. Tokyo is built over a seismic fault line and is subject to earthquakes. Since I first arrived in Tokyo in late 1983, I have been aware that this city is waiting for the next big one to occur. We get quakes all the time, from hardly noticeable to relatively strong shocks. However, none of the quakes that I experienced over the past 25 years came anywhere close to the shocking ferocity of the quake that happened on 11th March. I was surprised that more damage was not suffered in Tokyo, which is a testament to Japanese building technology. The problem is that Tokyo is a target for the next big quake. Big quakes struck the area in 1703, 1855, and 1923, with the last claiming the lives of 100,000 people. The city of Tokyo is located on the Kanto Plain, which sits atop of a tectonic triple junction. The greater metropolitan area of Tokyo has a population of 30 million people. Even a limited quake here would be damaging, and according to the historical cycle, we may already be overdue. My fear is that the recent earthquake was so powerful that it has disturbed the tectonic plates under the Kanto region, and that may hasten the arrival of the next big one, which just doesn't bear thinking about. Where I get my information from? I've been asked quite a few times whether I feel I am getting the latest information on the problems in Japan, especially the unfolding nuclear crisis. Culturally, there is a tendency to downplay and sometimes ignore bad news when it's not clear who is at fault. Additionally, Japanese can be over-trusting by relying on the government and authorities to have everyone's best interest at heart and do everything necessary to protect them. I am not Japanese, so I am less inclined to be unquestionably accept this thinking. Instead, I rely heavily on external media and other sources to keep me informed. The Irish Embassy in Tokyo has been regularly sending out helpful email advisories to all registered Irish citizens in Japan to update them on the developments. In addition, I've been able to access the British Embassy's advice bulletins, which are a lot more comprehensive and informative. These extracts from their most recent bulletin gave me comfort for believing that continuing to stay in Tokyo for now is an acceptable risk. We really think that the extreme worst case is now less likely. There is still cause for concern, but there are real indications that there is some progress. The only thing I would comment on is that radiation levels that the Japanese use in developing their recommendations are more cautious than the ones we have in the UK or Europe more generally. There is no reason from the point of view of radioactivity why you should not be able to continue to live quite happily in Tokyo. Sir John Beddington, UK Government Chief Scientific Advisor, in a briefing advisory teleconference with the British Embassy in Tokyo's... Nice that Sir John Beddington was safely in London at the time when he was having this teleconference with the British Embassy in Tokyo. Now, from my friend Henry. Again, from March 19th. Checking in with him. Tony, I think everyone freaked out early on. The Asia Wall Street Journal recently had an article titled, "Foreigners Tiptoe Back into the Office in Tokyo." Expats who fled the country early on are now returning to face a certain coldness from their colleagues who they'd abandoned. The scornful term "flyjin" has been coined. That's a play on a word, "gaijin," which you may or may not know means foreigner. So that's foreigners. Flyjin are foreigners coming back to cold receptions in offices they left to go seek cover. There's part of that mentality that tall poppies must get crushed. A lot of companies apparently triggered their disaster plans, something you and I know about, and moved operations to Osaka or out of Japan. I think they acted prematurely, a known problem with disaster plans. If companies relocated because Tokyo might have its own big earthquake or tsunami, they could have left town any time in the last 25 years. The risk for Tokyo hasn't changed. It's as huge as ever. There's been uninformed speculation that the Tokyo risk got worse on March 11th. That has no scientific basis, but the risk surely didn't lessen. The power has hardly failed in the central 23 wards of Tokyo, certainly not downtown where the foreign companies are. The power never failed at my apartment. Our gas meter was automatically shut off by the initial big quake, and I had to push the reset button. That was my sole outage. But more on the electric power below. Radiation risks, in my honest opinion, a horrific risk, obviously, for the heroic plant workers, firemen, police, and soldiers working near or in the nuclear plant itself. A modest risk for young, under 50 people living within a 20-kilometer exclusion zone. A slight risk for young, underage 50 people in the 20 to 30-kilometer stay-indoor zone, and no risk at all for the rest of us. I think the stories about food contamination are way overblown. The water contamination stories are specific to certain cities and towns. The big iodine panic for Tokyo occurred when the water at one Tokyo pumping plant was found, for one day only, to exceed safety standards for infants under 12 months, if drunk for a long period of time. There have been other specific water contaminations, and the local residents need to pay attention to all the qualifying statements. The foreign press tends to skip the limiting qualifiers and blast out attention-getting headlines like, "Tokyo water not safe to drink. Fish and produce from Japan contaminated." This has led to various levels of panic buying or the shunning of produce that is perfectly safe. I know a maker of automotive and electronic parts who had their shipments refused by European freight airlines. Germany was diverting container ships from the port of Tokyo. Nuts! I saw a nice PR photo of sailors scrubbing down the whole deck of the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan to get rid of radioactive contamination. Now, really. By the way, Japan does greatly appreciate the disaster aid U.S. forces are extending on the ground in the devastated area of Tohoku. I know a lot of Japanese get a knot in their stomach when they see marine landing craft hit their beach, but when the ramps drop, there's no screaming leathernecks charging off. Rather, it's loads of relief supplies or utility trucks of Tohoku Electric coming to fix the lines. We are getting background radiation reports every day from monitoring stations. The amounts are largely trivial. Admittedly, they are more trivial for me at age 67. People with small children or pregnant women might use a different definition of trivial. The nuclear plant may get worse, but it will be controlled eventually. The worst case outcome is that some radius from the plant becomes a dead zone where nobody can go for decades. Electric power shortages. This really is a big problem and will remain so for some years to come. Tokyo has had the most reliable electric power in the world. In 19 years, I've never experienced a blackout at home or at work. The Fukushima nuclear accident took away something like 5 gigawatts of generating capacity. Although there's been no official announcement, it's pretty obvious that that plant is gone forever as an electricity source. 5 gigawatts is a gigantic piece of baseload capacity. Replacing it is a very, very long-term proposition, especially since all nuclear plants on Earth, existing and planned, are now under suspicion, and coal plants are under the global warming cloud. Instantly, TEPCO's generating capacity was 25% below current demand. That's in mid-March with cold weather. An impossible situation. We went from Tokyo-level reliability to Tanzania-level reliability in a flash, and the train stoppages and the blackouts began. The earthquake was on a Friday. All trains stopped, and there were blackouts in suburban areas. As I said, the central 23 wards have had few blackouts. That weekend and the following Monday and Tuesday were pretty ragged as TEPCO fiddled with more train stoppages and the first scheduled rolling blackouts. Later in the week, the typically well-organized Japanese implemented many conservation measures. Trains were put on truncated but predictable service levels. Our Denen-Toshi line has no express trains running. Big power consumers like steel plants were asked to temporarily shut down. Consumers were asked to conserve power as much as possible. Everywhere, streets, stores, public buildings, train stations, many lights, escalators, and some elevators in each bank of elevators, and even a third of the train station ticket gates were turned off. Many stores had shorter hours. Famously, Tokyo Disneyland is shuttered as it had considerable liquefaction damage in its parking areas, and other amusement parks have shut off certain rides. Some night sports events have been canceled. TEPCO squeezed a few more watts out of its other plants and borrowed from other utilities. In spite of all that, the infamous scheduled rolling blackouts continued. This just shows how short the electric supply has become. Now that the weather has warmed a bit, we haven't had blackouts this week. This pleasant time should last through the end of May until the summer heat and its air conditioning load arrives. The government promises a plan by the end of April to deal with the summer. The blackouts, if they continue, are slowly killing many businesses, especially manufacturing businesses that run processes lasting many hours or days. Blackouts and product shortages lend a certain grimness to the day-to-day life. But people are coping and helping each other. People are a lot more polite on the street, if you can believe that. There's a certain martial spirit, like wartime, more slacks and practical clothes for women. Everyone carrying backpacks and scurrying very busily. Nobody complains because we only have to see one more photo from Tohoku to know how lucky we really are. Let me apologize to your wife and where her family lives. I believe it's in Chiba. I hope they incurred no damage. If they have experienced blackouts, I apologize for my privileged position here in Tokyo with no blackouts. I exercise as much Setsuden here at home as possible and always use stairs as available. I visit my mother-in-law at her nursing home in Kanagawa 3 times a week. I was present for one of the 3-hour blackouts for a nursing home with scheduled meals as well as bodily care and medical care to perform for the residents, many of whom are senile. 3 hours without power or water is a very long time. From Neil on March 19, 2011. Tony, very unsure now about what's going on with these reactors. No clear info, but now they are talking about contaminated water and food. I'm expecting another panic buying spree on dried and canned food. Anyway, time will tell. Levels are at 200 here at the moment in the water. I wonder how long it took them to decide at 200, not 105, 100 being the safe limit for infants, 300 being the safe limit for adults. I have 37 liters of bottled water, got 30 liters an hour after the quake, and was able to get a few more liters here and there since. This is really surreal. Last night, after the Japanese government announced that there was problems with the water, I saw people running into the supermarket near my house to get the water after they announced it, but I saw it first on CNN. I worked at the MOFA today, and they told me that the government won't let overseas relief and emergency doctors practice here because they don't have a Japanese license. There are over 300 plus of them waiting around in Tokyo. Just waiting. That's why on CNN you only see comments from the Japanese doctors, none from any foreign doctors. Nor can foreign doctors distribute medicine that they've brought with them because it's not Japanese government approved. I hope this comes out eventually. It's clear that they didn't apply any post-Kobe quake review to their rationality. Thanks for all the concern, man. Hope you're all okay. Neil. Now, about a week ago, I wrote to my friends again. My wife is Japanese, and every summer she plans on spending at least 5 weeks in Japan, 4 weeks, takes the children with her. Right now, we're not sure what to do. There are a number of reasons why we're not sure what to do. So I wrote to my friends, and ask them the following question. Do you recommend my family coming to Japan this summer? I know you live there and it would be strange to say don't come here, but my best guess from the sources I read is that at least there will be troubles with electricity for the next several months. Trouble is, we have to pay for tickets soon, and they are non-refundable, and they keep increasing in price. They're up to $2,000 for one child now. My wife has a free ticket, but in December the tickets are even cheaper at $1,100 apiece. But their time to stay in Japan would be much shorter if they go in the wintertime. So here's from Dermot. Tony, the only concerns I would have are about the nuclear situation. Even now, more than 2 weeks have passed and the eventual outcome is uncertain. The news changes daily and it seems that the Japanese government is not on top of the situation and we have to rely on the information they get from TEPCO, the operators of the power plant. When will they declare that the situation is under control and safe? I just don't know, and until there is some certainty about that problem, it's difficult for me to give you an opinion about your wife and children visiting Japan this summer. The issue about electric power cuts is only an inconvenience and should not prevent them from coming. The safety issue is the nuclear problem, which could suddenly get worse without warning if the engineers don't quickly get to grips with the situation. Right now, there is no real risk to people living or visiting the Tokyo area. It's the uncertainty factor that makes it difficult for me to provide a clear answer to your question. And I encourage all listeners and people who look at the show notes to click on the link that's Kaloran in Tokyo. KaloranInTokyo.wordpress.com. Get the latest news of what's really going on from the perspective of a long-term Irish resident. From Henry. Tony, I wouldn't hesitate to come to Japan. Tokyo is still Tokyo. That said, I'm fully expecting a summer without air conditioning at home, and with many other restrictions to be laid out in the upcoming government plan for the summer. One item mentioned is daylight savings time. If they try that, I have a private opinion we'll have a mini Y2K mess because every piece of software in Japan is written with the assumption of unchanging time. Springing ahead isn't too bad, but falling back, those timestamps go to hell. If we do spring ahead, I'll bet we'll make it permanent and never fall back. I'm a little puzzled that you find air rates rising. Foreign travel to Japan has dropped dramatically and I would expect bargains. Another place to look for bargains is in Hawaii. Hawaii is very dependent on Japanese tourists and this trade has also collapsed. Maybe your relatives in Japan could meet you in Hawaii for an Anshin holiday. Keep gardening. And from Neil, I think it would be better to leave it till next winter. Let all this blow over, huh? No need to put yourselves under any pressure then. In saying that, everything is starting to be restocked again. Power and trains aren't really a big problem, but if a big black gooey cloud comes across, they'll start another panic. Then you wouldn't want to be here holidaying, because again, there'll be an exodus out, flights will be stopped for sure. Some carriers have already pulled out of Tokyo, and many have cut back flights. I received an email today from the New Zealand Embassy saying that they are mailing out to New Zealand residents in Tokyo potassium iodide tablets. I'm not sure if I should take mine. Should I give them to your family that's here near Tokyo? I don't know if they would take them from me because they didn't come from the Japanese government, but I don't know. Anyways, I'll hold on to them, and if you need me to get them anything, just let me know. I think it's better to err on the side of caution now, being that I was really surprised that the New Zealand Embassy was sending out the mail and saying that the potassium iodide tablets should be here within 2 days. Being what they are, the Japanese government isn't saying anything to its public, and what they might be telling foreign governments may be way different. Some embassies have moved to Osaka, and this doesn't pass the smell test. Just not sure. Here's a quote from the New Zealand government. The tablets should not be taken unless authorities in Japan or New Zealand advise you to do so. This advice is likely to follow the Japanese authorities issuing an order to take shelter because a radiation cloud is expected to pass over an area. Thanks, Tony. I will continue to keep in touch with family and friends in Japan, and especially now as we monitor the situation of when and or if my family will visit this year. That's it for today. Now go out and do something useful.